Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting the show today by taking a look at federal historic preservation rules. And a great guest for you today, Sarah Bronin, is chair of the Federal Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. Sarah also is an architect and a law professor at Cornell University, and her latest book is titled Key to the City: How Zoning Shapes Our World. It was published earlier this month by Norton & Company. As we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about the Federal Historic Preservation Review process and maybe how it could be changed? Do the current regulations prevent renovating and reusing historic buildings? Maybe a balance could be struck? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Sarah Bronin, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry.
In 2022, you were confirmed by the U.S. Senate to chair the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. Tell us about the council and the influence it may or may not have over historic preservation regulations nationwide.
Well, the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation is the independent federal historic preservation agency. And as its name suggests, it does do advising. So it does advise the president and Congress and other federal agencies and state and local governments on preservation policy. But it also oversees a regulatory process that requires the federal government to take into account, that's the phrase that's used, take into account the effects of their actions on historic properties. So what is a historic property for our purposes? It could be a building. It could be a structure like a bridge. It could be an archaeological resource. It could be a tribal cultural property or landscape. There's a lot of different ins and outs of our process, but maybe with that overview, we can continue the discussion.
Yeah, the council proposed an accelerated review process for historic preservation projects. Why is that needed?
So our review process was set out by the National Historic Preservation Act back in 1966, and again, has these steps that our agency has developed over time to ensure that historic properties are taken into account. In some cases, we found that the full process, it was called Section 106, the full Section 106 process is not needed because certain types of things that the federal government does won't have negative effects on historic properties. And so what we're trying to do is to use all the best practices that we and state historic preservation offices and tribal historic preservation offices have seen over time and say, look, we've observed these kinds of activities. We don't think they will have adverse effects, or we know that with certain strategies, we can minimize or eliminate their adverse effects. And we can move forward. And so what do we mean by activities? So the kinds of things that we're proposing include, for example, making it easier for historic buildings that receive federal funding to be converted to housing, that enable us to make historic buildings more energy efficient, and also to move forward certain transportation projects, including pedestrian projects like sidewalk repairs and crosswalk striping. So these are, it's a huge range of you know, federal government actions, but again, we're using what we've learned to say, hey, these don't need further review. And in fact, a lot of them make sure that buildings can be reused and historic districts can be accessed.
Yeah. I saw somewhere, I think 40% of the housing in the country is 50 years or older, or older, and a lot of it very much older.
Yes, I think that stat is right. And that's housing that exists today, that's not even including all of those older buildings that could be converted to housing. So you look at the pandemic and the federal government not using as much office space, so having some buildings that might be converted over to housing. You see in the private sector, the office sector downtown is flagging a bit. Those buildings might use federal funding to convert to housing. So the 40% of historic housing is one stat, but then you have all these other buildings that are not housing now but could be housing, and those could be put to good use.
So how do the current rules hinder this renovation and reuse of historic buildings for housing?
Well, we like to say from our agency's perspective that the full process certainly enables for agencies to thoroughly weigh the impact of their actions. And so our process right now in many cases requires sort of individualized decisions that go through the whole process. But what this program proposal is saying is, that process is great, and let's use what we've learned through that process to identify those things that don't need to go through the full process. So we try not to think of it in terms of, these our own process being a barrier, but we try to think of this proposal as being an opportunity for us as preservationists to identify for ourselves the things that we think will work for our historic properties.
Mm. Jeff in Superior, Wisconsin, has a comment, I believe. Jeff, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. Beautiful sunny day up here on the shores of Lake Superior. So I wanted to share a story of what happened here in Superior. We used to have a theater in East End that is now a hardware store. And what the owners have done is put up a movie screen so when you're shopping, you can be watching an old Western or something. And we had another situation where we had a curling club downtown Superior on Banks Avenue where the grocery store tore the curling club down, but they have photographs of the old curling club up on the walls in the grocery store. So what I'm trying to say is there's many ways to preserve the memory of a building or a site.
Yeah.
I love those examples. And that shows, in my opinion, how creative people who, the people who love historic buildings and historic places can be. I mean, I love to see historic places being repurposed, reused, modernized, to meet the hardware needs of the community in that case. And I love those examples. How fun. I'll have to visit sometime.
It's a beautiful place to visit. I could tell you that for sure, Sarah. I was thinking about an example of a housing situation, and this goes back quite a ways, but there was something called the Tenney Building, which was a medical facility in downtown Madison, and when they moved to a new facility, that building was turned into apartments. And providing, some decent housing right downtown in the city of Madison. And there are probably other people who've got examples like that as well.
So we are seeing increased interest in people living in historic downtowns, on small town main streets, because those places tend to be not only more vibrant, because there's always been a mix of uses in historic neighborhoods, but they also tend to be more beautiful, just more sort of appealing. And I love that we are seeing an increased interest in conversions of buildings for housing. And it's my view, and it's actually the view of our agency, that we've said there in our policy statement that we adopted last year, that's part of our advising role, by the way, in the policy statement that historic neighborhoods benefit from housing. The small town main streets benefit, downtowns benefit, even those places, where you might not expect benefit from more housing, more feet on the street, more people in the stores, more people in that hardware store watching those movies. So that's kind of our general view is like, let's go with housing, let's do it. That's what we've always done as preservationists.
Michael in Appleton will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks to your guests as well. I was recently on a trip to Portugal. I was lucky enough to go with my family. And in Porto, one of the historic buildings we were shown was, like, it was a beautiful building, and the entire exterior had been preserved and everything like that. But it was McDonald's. and, you know, like, as pretty a McDonald's as it might be, it feels a little bit cheap or chintzy to turn a historic building like that into a McDonald's to me.
Okay. Well, you want to comment on that, Sarah?
Gosh, I mean, so for me, it's hard to judge or to view negatively any entity that is investing in revitalizing a historic property. And I think part of what we see sometimes in preservation is this perception, real or perceived, that the preservationist might be a little snobby sometimes. My role as chair, my goal as a preservationist is to say, you know what, we've got to let buildings respond to the needs and of the community and to the market. So in that particular case, if you know, that particular business was the business that was willing to invest, that brought the building back to life, that brings people in to a community, you know, I mean, it's hard to you know, not look, what's the phrase, look that gift horse in the eye, or not look, you know, whatever the phrase is there. Yeah. It's hard to say, you know, that as a preservationist, you kind of object to the tenants. So I'm not going to say that. And so I'll say, you know, I look forward to seeing some photos of that, though, seeing how they integrated their branding, which, you know, is a big part of any franchise, with the historic fabric.
I've talked to many builders over the years. I have some friends or acquaintances, at least in Madison and other areas of Milwaukee, of Wisconsin as well. And they usually complain bitterly about the cost and the rules and the regulations that they have to go through. And then oftentimes just to get it turned down when they're trying to reuse an older, you know, an old building. And it sounds like you're trying to address that in some ways.
You know, there, a lot of what you're, you know, what you might be hearing is that there are different levels of review. So for us as a federal agency, our processes and our reviews really relate to federal agency action, not so much to maybe state and local commission reviews. We do hear a lot, though, from people who have undergone a local commission review process. So they go in front of their neighbors or members of their community who then say, you know, yes, you can do this, or you can do this with these conditions, or maybe sometimes they reject it. And that level of scrutiny is not something that most people are used to. When you buy into historic district, or when a historic district comes to you, let's say your community votes to adopt a historic district where you are, you do have that additional layer of process. So some people view it as a positive, so that, you know, people don't do something wild in their neighborhood. Others do view it as a restriction. I hope that, you know, as we're doing at the federal level, that state and local regulators, at whatever point they touch property owners and their historic properties, kind of continue to weigh the balance of the good of historic preservation, the beauty that it brings, with people's, you know, real needs on the ground, real needs to modernize their structures. And I do think that's an important balance.
Yeah. Sarah Bronin chairs the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation, and we're talking with her about some changes proposed for historic reservation process policies with her. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1110. 1234, or you could email us, email address talk@WPR. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Sarah Bronin, who chairs the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. It's an independent federal agency and oversees the nation's historic preservation policy. Great to have her with us. And certainly, I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Somebody sent in a photo of the Portugal McDonald's restaurant. It says it is absolutely worth a visit, including the interior. That was, frankly, in need of restoration. And so it does look pretty nice in the photo that I have in front of me. Sarah, let's talk more. You're proposing, the council proposed an accelerated review process. What are the intricacies of that accelerated review process?
Well, for example, we say that when there's federal funding to convert a building from, let's say, an office building to housing, there's a lot of flexibility in the interior of the building where it doesn't impact the external facade for an entity to come in and reconfigure. Because we all know offices do not make for great apartments. So you got to reconfigure the walls on the inside. And right now our rules tend to require or trigger, you know, more of a review process as to what happens on the interior. Similarly, we have looked at exteriors, and some of the things in the draft include identifying which facades are not significant and allowing a lot of changes to happen to those, and maybe pursuing more gradual changes or changes after what we call a qualified professional has given the okay for things like a window replacement on a historically significant facade. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that, if you're talking about the details for our proposal, those are the kinds of things that are in it.
And, you know, a real goal is to make it easier to create more affordable housing, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Affordable housing and you know, really all kinds of housing, because we've seen lots of studies that show that just the more housing you create across the board, the better. But, of course, we know the federal government is largely in the business of subsidizing and creating affordable housing. And that's what our process, you know, relates to, is really this federal actions and federal funding.
Yeah, and as I think as we, I don't know what the figures are, but we, across the country there, it seems to be a housing shortage, if I'm not mistaken.
I think we're seeing that in lots of places across the country, in communities, rural, suburban, urban alike.
And you talk about the fact that this process or the proposal would create more energy efficient and climate resilient buildings if this preservation process was more streamlined. Why is that?
So, you know, when we look at what's been happening during this administration, the Biden administration, we've seen a huge investment in energy efficiency and renewable energy. And every dollar that is going out under these programs that Congress and the president have created, the bipartisan infrastructure law and so on, that will all go through our Section 106 process. So what we've said as a body, we last year adopted a policy statement, a very official sounding name, on climate change and historic preservation. And what we said in that document was we need to make it easier for historic buildings, whether they're housing or not, to be made more energy efficient and to integrate renewable energy. So if we're kind of taking that as a starting point, then we have to say to ourselves, all right, how is our regulatory process going to change to actually make that happen? And I think, you know, what we're proposing, so we do have a part of that, the program comment on housing. We also have a part on just buildings generally, so whether they're federally owned or they're federally funded or permitted, we, you know, have seen that there's a big need for us to streamline. So is weather stripping and caulking, is that a valid action? Well, we said in the program comment, for any building, that's go forward. You know, go forth and prosper, federal agencies. Go and insulate all you want. You know, from a weather stripping perspective, we do talk about insulation. We talk about low flow water filter, conservation measures. We talk about energy efficient windows and other types of improvements like that. That where our process would be clarified for all buildings, not just housing.
How difficult is it now to upgrade electrical systems and upgrade the energy efficiency of historic buildings?
You know, I think it's so. So in general, we've seen. Let's just stepping really, you know, back. Historic buildings, especially those 50, 60 years and older, tend to be pretty energy efficient. Because they have thicker walls than modern buildings, because they have, you know, the kinds of windows that were built to last. We do see, however, the need for those buildings to become more energy efficient using modern technologies and to diversify their energy sources, including things like adding solar panels. So building decarbonization, that's kind of maybe a catchphrase that some of you have heard of, taking the carbon intensity in terms of building operations out of building operations, reducing the energy that it costs to that it takes to operate a building, and then actually, you know, in the case of solar panels, enabling a building to actually positively contribute back to the grid.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And as on a personal note, the house I live in now, I bought it was a 1906 home, and I did all of the upgrades all of the tightening and all interior, the exterior looks just like it always did, but the interior has is now an Energy Star home, I guess you could call it. That's in fact what it's designated at. So it can be done, and in the end, I've been able to save, and I think this is on my little personal level here. I've been able to save some things, but. If more of that could be done across the nation, I think we'd all be better off.
Absolutely. In fact, we refer to energy efficient and Energy Star appliances in the draft as well, because we know that those energy efficient appliances and also electric appliances is a big priority across all building types, including housing.
Jennifer in De Pere called to ask, and here, and we just talked about this, is there flexibility in federal historic preservation to allow for adding solar panels or solar shingles to a historic building? She was told they couldn't do that on their old home in a historic district. And there, Jennifer's wondering, is there a push for flexibility? It sounds like there is.
You know, our proposal would add flexibility in situations where maybe local historic commissions haven't allowed as of yet. So we may be moving forward in a way that, you know, will encourage some state and local folks who are reviewing these, you know, similar projects to also to loosen or to make more flexible their standards. So I wrote, as chair of the advisory council, a long report, it's actually 600 pages if you count the appendices, to my fellow members about federal historic preservation standards and the need for them to become more flexible. Interestingly, our agency doesn't actually establish these federal standards. It's the Department of the Interior. And so they are one of our 24 council members. So we are an independent agency, but we're also a council. We have about 10 federal agencies on our council, and we've encouraged the Department of the Interior to really take to heart some of the suggestions that we got when we were evaluating their standards from the field. And, you know, like your caller, it's sometimes ambiguous or sometimes a little tough to see how the field might continue to evolve in a consistent way in a way that honors that flexibility that preservationists are known for. I mean, you go back to some of the examples your earlier caller said, we're known for being creative and flexible. So let's embrace that. That's really my approach.
Kevin in Madison will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
So my situation is kind of a funny one. This was like maybe 20 years ago, but a person in my neighborhood, and it was a historical district, bought a building, and it was previously for years a taxidermy shop.
Okay.
And he opened a pizza restaurant. Our city wouldn't let him take the sign down. For 2 years. So, you know, the historical thing can go a little bit extreme sometimes.
And if you're on Twitter or LinkedIn, tag me at Sarah Bronin, S-A-R-A-B-R-O-N-I-N. I got to see a picture of that one. That one sounds amazing.
Kevin, thank you very much for calling. By the way, you can join in, too. What questions or comments or maybe an experience to share do you have? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Ron in La Crosse will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ron.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to find out if there's any effort to collectivize the egress. In other words, these small buildings oftentimes don't have adequate second exits and elevators, which limits the upper floors in many downtowns like La Crosse and other small towns in Wisconsin to not be able to afford those improvements. That's a big hurdle, maybe $250,000 or more. Is there any effort to collectivize those with these smaller buildings to share where it seems like it could work, that cost with the government to, in effect, we subsidize roads, obviously, and this is a vertical access way, if you will. So kind of like vertical roads, in effect, in these smaller buildings.
Yeah. Ron, thank you for calling. Comment on that, Sarah?
You know, that's an interesting one. I mean, I think a lot of what you know, your callers are talking about it sometimes zoning with the taxidermy pizza shop, and in this case, building codes and the need to ensure that buildings are accessible. A lot of our work at the agency focuses on the regulatory side, so the permitting process and how if an elevator is proposed, it can be nicely integrated into the historic building. On the other hand, you know, you raise a good point about government's role in subsidizing and supporting accessibility improvements in historic properties. Now, I don't know of an elevator fund for private buildings that's, you know, very specific to historic buildings, but I do agree with you that we invest an awful lot of money on some things, and I would include highways to your point in that. A group, billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars. And if a drop in that, you know, drop in the bucket could do a huge amount for making our historic buildings more accessible. I'll just note that on the road side, especially in the federal interstate highway side, Congress has actually exempted interstate highways from our process. So when you're thinking about priorities, when you're thinking about sort of congressional, this was years ago, congressional priorities and kind of how we manage that process, you know, you do wonder, how did that come about? Because we know that highways and highway expansion definitely has a lot of impact on historic places and not necessarily good ones.
Yeah. I interviewed an engineer who had written a book on that process about how engineers actually create more problems sometimes because of the way they go about setting up roads and the kinds of problems that happen, and avoid proposals that would be more people friendly. And I think in your proposal, it could result in more bicycle lanes, more sidewalks, and more public transport or transit projects. Is that correct? And talk about that.
Sure. And that's maybe the flip there, the parallel to, you know, the question of how buildings can become more accessible. So, you know, the elevators and the ramps and those kinds of things. This is how communities and historic districts can become more accessible by allowing people to arrive at them using a lot of different methods. So you've already heard we have a policy preference embedded in laws at every level for roads. That's just the, how things have evolved. And so if we want to promote other kinds of ways of getting around, I guess buses use roads, so let's put that on there, but bike lanes, better sidewalks, better transit, you know, bus stop facilities and so on, we have to write that into our policies. So we really do need to, I think, put the thumb on the scales for the kinds of transportation alternatives that we do address in the program comment. So our agency has proposed, put the draft out there for this document that enables any agency that's putting in a sidewalk or that's maybe striping a road. And that can happen not just by departments of transportation or the Federal Department of Transportation, but it can also happen with other entities like military facilities, which have roads that the military manages, or large public housing complexes and so on. So it's not just the DOTs that that deal in these kinds of actions. So we're hoping, you know, that helps, again, put the thumb on the scales to different types of transportation alternatives.
Yeah. And you're working, are you working with Indian tribes to make sure this proposal addresses their concerns about preserving historic buildings and landmarks?
Yes, I think, you know, a lot of what, so we did finish our first, our round of tribal consultation and public comment. We always hear from Indigenous tribes, Native Hawaiian organizations, and other Indigenous peoples about the need to be very cautious about activities that would disturb ground, for example, in particular, as opposed to necessarily significant concerns about historic buildings. And, you know, we're still going through our comments, but we view those very, very carefully. In a broader sense, we have seen significant engagement with various members of Indian tribes and Native Hawaiian organizations. And just Monday, I announced that our agency had adopted what I hope is a groundbreaking policy that recognizes Indigenous knowledge of Native Hawaiian organizations. And it says that in our Section 106 process, when a Native Hawaiian organization is doing a federally funded or permitted or supported activity that involves their Indigenous knowledge, involves their traditional sites and practices, that they and not the federal government are the experts. And so, you know, we're trying to get the federal government out of the process of getting involved with interpretations of Indigenous knowledge. And that was a first step. So, you know, we continue to cultivate our relationship with Indian tribes and Native Hawaiian organizations, and we do it carefully and in consultation.
Thinking about money as we go along, is there a proposal to make more money available to communities to perhaps break down barriers to housing?
Meaning?
I mean, is there federal money? I mean, is there going to be federal money tied to or become a part of the proposals that you have forwarded?
Yes, I see. So there is already a significant amount of funding that is devoted to the activities that we have identified. Our agency doesn't provide the funding, but if you look at the $10 billion in the DOT budget for safer streets, multimodal transportation, and the billions that DOT is spending on public transit. If you look at the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, you know, and associated in related funds, $27 billion, I think the number is. If you look at the investments that HUD makes simply in maintaining their existing housing stock, you know, this is something that, you know, also runs in the billions, and a lot of that is devoted to properties that are designated historic just by virtue, you know, of the significance of public housing, but also their age. And that's not to mention all of the federal dollars that are going through community block grants, community development block grants, through state and local governments to housing and to energy efficiency and other and transportation upgrades. So, you know, my perspective is we've seen that these funding for these activities has significantly ramped up, which means that we're seeing a significant number of new activities that are kind of running down the pipeline and will have to undergo a review process. So we're trying to get ahead of that a bit and to say, as this additional funding comes in, you know, we need to review projects smarter and more efficiently. Maybe our process will trigger additional funding that's devoted specifically to historic buildings. That would be a great outcome.
Yeah, it would indeed. I think one of the other complaints, or I mean, I don't know if it's a complaint is the right word, or comment on the whole process when it comes to working on historic preservation and getting those buildings up to code and the work that gets done is the interest rates that have vacillated quite a bit over the years and over the last couple of years in particular, and how that affected the whole process of housing, and for example. And so some interest rate stability, I think, would be important for a lot of people who are involved in this.
You know, yeah, I mean, I can't comment so much on the financial markets and on interest
sure.
rates, but it's all related. So we have to make improvements in lots of different areas, and we're doing our little part at the agency.
Our guest today, Sarah Bronin, who chairs the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. It's a great conversation I'm having with her. Excuse me. And I hope you'll join in. Questions for her, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email address talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today on the show, we'll learn from state and federal ecologists about the effects of neonicotinoid pesticides on the environment. Right now, we're visiting with Sarah Bronin, who chairs the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. It's an independent federal agency. It oversees the nation's historic preservation policy. And great to have Sarah Bronin with us. She's an architect and law professor at Cornell University. Her latest book is Key to the City, How Zoning Shapes Our World, just published last month by Norton & Company. So great to have her with us. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. David emailed to say that once he once observed a conflict between federal agency representatives evaluating work on a historic lighthouse on how to make it accessible for persons with disabilities. The accommodation did not mesh with the perspective of the preservationist. David says he doesn't know how that issue was resolved, but what are your thoughts about the issue, accessibility for wheelchairs, et cetera?
Well, we've said as an agency in our program comments and our policy statements that accessibility is a high priority, and really in our policy statements, I should say, that the Americans with Disabilities Act is sometimes seen as a requirement that could conflict with historic preservation. But in my view, I'm a licensed architect. I don't think, you know, that kind of perspective, I think, is limiting in terms of its viewpoint, because a good architect, a good project manager can make accessibility work in almost every circumstance. And I'm not talking about an 18th century house museum, right? You're not going to put stick an elevator on most of those, right, on the outside or something like that. So those might have to be those those types of properties that rely on different kinds of accessibility through videos and something else. But for the most part, historic buildings can and should be made accessible, especially, I mean, the public buildings that are subject to the Americans with Disabilities Act, of course, in particular.
Oh, if at all, does your agency work with state or local agencies like, you know, Wisconsin State Historic Preservation Office or the Madison Trust for Historic Preservation?
Sure. Our process, our normal process, our Section 106 process, does provide a role for state historic preservation officers as offices or officers, as well as local governments. And so, you know, there's a lot of back and forth. I appointed as chair two organizations, the National Alliance of Preservation Commissions and the National Preservation Partners Network, as observers to the ACHP. So I can appoint up to five myself, and I've appointed five actually as of last week. I added a fifth one, the Permitting Council. But I have appointed those bodies because they bring that state and local expertise to our discussions, and I want them at the table. So there's a role in the regulatory process. There's a role through our membership and in the advising process. I myself served as chair of a statewide preservation organization, Preservation Connecticut, and I also served on my local historic district commission in the city of Hartford, which is Connecticut's capital city. So I, again, myself have had experience at both the local and state levels before getting over here to Washington, D.C., and I greatly, greatly value it in our agency as a whole. Values the input of state and local partners.
Yeah. The election's coming up soon. And I'm wondering, do you anticipate support for the council's proposal regardless of who wins the election?
Historic preservation tends to be a bipartisan issue. People from all sides of the political spectrum are all parts of the political spectrum, I guess, I think recognize the value of historic places. So I think the council will continue to move forward in it across anything that comes before us for a better, more effective approach to our processes where we think it aligns with preservation values because it, you know, actually in the case, again, for this particular proposal, hopefully it will enable the continued use of historic buildings and the enjoyment of historic districts and sites. And that, again, that's a pro-preservation outcome.
Yeah, it is indeed. And someone else is wondering, do you have a way for people to look at the proposal?
Sure. It's available on our website, achp.gov. You could also follow the USACHP on social media, and we'd love to connect. And I'm personally at Sarah Bronin on social media or LinkedIn. So I definitely talk a lot about this proposal and everything that we're doing. So feel free to find me or at Chair Bronin on Twitter.
And you took leave from your tenured position as a tenured faculty member. At Wisconsin, I can understand that. But this must have been really important for you to take this position, and maybe why.
I'm not hearing any audio.
Oh,
I'm not sure.
Are you hearing me now?
Yes, I heard you now. The last thing I heard from you is you said that, you know, I took a leave from Cornell University, and that is absolutely correct. They were very gracious to give me a two-year leave to pursue this position here in D.C.
It was pretty cool. And you're obviously, as I mentioned, you're an architect and an author, and you have a new book published earlier this month, Key to the City, How Zoning Shapes Our World. How central to city government are zoning rules? Pretty central, I would think.
Absolutely. So, you know, just to put on my non-ACHP hat here and say that, you know, zoning is the thing that dictates almost everything that gets built in this country. So virtually every city in the country, other than my hometown, believe it or not, of Houston, has zoning. And so when you look at look around you, almost anywhere you are, you can see how communities have developed. And if you have the patience to read a 150-page zoning code, or in some cases, City of Boston, almost 3,800-page zoning code, you can really match the rules on the page to what you see around you. And that's really what Key to the City is about. It's trying to educate people on what zoning is and why we should take an interest in it.
And how can zoning improve a community?
Well, zoning can be used to actually create very positive outcomes in terms of better housing, in terms of more equitable and connected places, in terms of sustainability, things like tree canopy coverage and eliminating minimum parking requirements have win-wins for the individual property owner, for the neighborhood, the community as a whole.
And here you are. You're a native of Houston, Texas, which I think is the only major city without zoning.
Absolutely. Yep, it is. The only one that we found so far. Now, that said, there are a lot of smaller jurisdictions, a lot of counties and small towns that don't have zoning, but, you know, they're a lot of them tend to be pretty small in population. That's why I say the only large city without zoning.
I just wondered how that has affected Houston. I imagine in many, many ways.
Largely for the worse, and I talk about that in the book. In fact, I start chapter one of the book in Houston, where I grew, in the block where I grew up. And because there's no zoning right across from the block, there's a gas station, a self-storage facility, a strip mall, a nightclub. You know, that's not exactly a great place for a kid to grow up.
Jake and Madison may have one final question here. Jake, hi.
Hi, great show. I'd love your comments on, I live on Williamson Street in Madison, and for the past 20 years, we're really not allowed to do any upgrades for windows and things like that on our houses. But in a short amount of time, in a couple of years, a lot of these houses are just going to be demolished and five-story condos are going to be put up. And just wanted to get your comment on kind of that. I don't think that makes a lot of sense for over-regulating some areas.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's exactly why I am really pushing for this program comment, this proposal. Because if we cannot modernize our historic buildings, they will become obsolete. They will, you know, be put on the chopping block. And that's just not something that I, as a preservationist, want to see. It's not something that any preservationist should want. So we have to, like, just really reverse course in a lot of ways on the flexibility that we provide. You know, get out of that mindset of, oh, if anything changes, that's a defeat. Actually, if things change, that's a victory. That means people are investing in their buildings. And I'm not saying, you know, let's, you know, do something crazy. But I think the kinds of changes that we're proposing in the program comment will really go a long way to helping communities thrive and renew their investment in historic buildings in particular.
Jake, thank you very much. And Sarah, thank you very much for taking an hour of your time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. I know our listeners have as well. And the email address of the council is up now as a link on our program notes for today at the Larry Mueller Show. And again, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry. Talk soon.
Sarah Bronin chairs the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation, independent federal agency, and overseeing the nation's historic preservation policy. And we'll have a link to the policy itself as well on the Larry Mueller Show website. So look to that for more information. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the effects of neonicotinoids on our environment with our two guests for you. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, turning our attention now to neonicotinoids. More than 18 experts will speak next Wednesday at the Wisconsin Neonics Forum in Madison. And two of the speakers are with us today to talk about neonic pesticides. One is Mike Miller, stream biologist or ecologist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Bureau of Water Quality. Mike, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Larry. I appreciate the opportunity.
Travis Schmidt is our other guest. Travis is a research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Wyoming Montana Water Science Center. And Travis, welcome. Thank you for taking some time to be with us as well.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to talk about this important subject.
As we talk with our experts today, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about the threats posed by these widely used insecticides? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Mike, let me turn to you first. Next Wednesday, as I mentioned, you're both going to be giving presentations. The program for the forum says you are going to be providing an overview of neonics and the risks they pose to the environment. So let's do a little. What are neonic pesticides?
Sure. Thanks, Larry. So most of you realize that plants like tobacco produce nicotine, and other plants as well, like potatoes and tomatoes, they produce nicotine to ward off insect pests. So in essence, what neonicotinoid insecticides are a synthetic version of nicotine. And again, the goal is it's an insecticide to, again, ward off insect pests in our crop fields.
And how do they affect, how do neonics affect insects?
Sure. Again, they work on the central nervous system of insects and some other animals, so they disrupt communication between muscles and tissues and the brain itself.
And let me turn to Travis for a minute as well. How do neonics wind up in surface and groundwater?
Oh, well, they're applied for a variety of reasons. Crops is one of them. They're also applied on buildings and on pets to try to deal with pests in all those situations. And they're very soluble, so they dissolve in water and eventually make their way into streams and rivers and lakes and groundwater.
Yeah, and they don't just kill the harmful insects or the ones that people don't want, Mike.
Thank you. Yeah. Again, so we refer to them as broad-spectrum pesticides, where, again, they're extremely toxic to insect pests, and that's great. But, again, they don't discriminate between pests and, you know, very valuable insects.
Yeah, for sure. David in Mercer, Minocqua area, has a comment. Let's go there. David, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I live in an area of northern Wisconsin, the Mercer, Minocqua area, and over the last 2 years, I've noticed that there's a very marked reduction in bumblebees on my patio flowers. And I was wondering, this is in an agricultural area, and could there be another cause explaining why the bumblebees are no longer coming along like they used to?
Again, certainly if it is a pesticide or insecticide problem, again, there's a number of different uses for these pesticides, insecticides, as Travis had mentioned. And again, one of them is people apply them to their yards to control mosquitoes, and there's other applications around the household, again, as far as for your ornamental plants and, again, other applications. So, again, it's not just an agricultural chemical, but it's used for a wide variety of different applications.
Yeah. Comment, Travis?
Yeah, if people even put them on their pets. I mean, when you're trying to get rid of fleas on your pets, you're sometimes using fipronil or imidacloprid.
Yeah. So, and this could lead to, obviously, and it has probably led to a reduction in our insect populations.
Right. And I'll defer to Travis on this. This is one of his areas of expertise.
Yeah, Travis?
Yeah, so I've been involved with trying to understand how pesticides and insecticides specifically have impacted stream insects all over the country.
Our Kristen Adams has something that I think relates to this. Chris, hi.
Hi. I have a little balcony. It's the only garden I have, and I buy between $300 and $600 worth of plants every year to put out there. And so last winter, we pulled everything in the house, and I overwintered them, and that was more or less successful. So I put them back up for the summer, and I brought them back in the house, and I've got them in the house now with grow lights, and I'm wondering if the neonicotinoids reduce in strength over periods of time like that.
Oh, so do they lose potency so they're less harmful to insects?
So I'll feel that. So one, they're relatively long-lived. They can last in the soil for tens of years, but they do break down over time. They break down more rapidly in, say, an aquatic environment in the water column. But again, they would break down. And it should be noted that some home stores, they pre-treat their plants that you buy in the store with neonics. And some of these stores have actually discontinued the use or the practice of pre-treating house plants with these chemicals.
Oh, interesting. Chris, thank you so much for calling. And Tom in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. I have a question. I do research up in northern Wisconsin in a forested area for the last 50 years, and the butterfly populations have crashed. I mean, totally crashed. We're down to probably 15-20% of what we had just 6-7 years ago, and there's been no spraying, nothing done up there. And my question is, having worked on PCBs on Green Bay, are you sampling rainwater? Does this stuff, is water soluble? It's in the water. Does it evaporate up, and can it be deposited elsewhere? PCBs on Green Bay on a nice day like today that's sunny and bright and windy actually becomes a source of PCBs rather than a sink. And, you know, and that's the question. Is this stuff atmospheric?
Yeah. For the limited amount of monitoring we've done in the state of Wisconsin, we are finding these and other neonics and other pesticides in our surface waters in the forested north. So again, that suggests that there's atmospheric transport of these chemicals.
Yeah, Travis, anything to add there?
I'm less aware of that, but I do know that imidacloprid is often used as an injection around trees to try to control infestations in trees in people's yards, and sometimes by the management land use agencies as a way to mitigate a pest around places like campsites and stuff like that.
Tom, thanks. Mary Kay in Kenosha, your turn. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi. First of all, they should be posting what they're using on the properties, okay? Second of all, we need to go back to natural predators and more vinegars, something that's safer.
Just one, to me, interesting anecdote on that is that there's been a few studies that show that when in agricultural applications of neonics, it actually, in addition to reducing some of the pests, it also reduces some of the natural predators of these pest insect species and actually promotes some pest outbreaks by, again, killing the native predators. So, again, your concerns are well-founded.
And the another interesting thing, and I think I saw it in something that one of you may have written, a lot of the neonicotinoid use in agriculture comes right in the seeds themselves, like corn seed, you're planting these seeds, and they are infused with neonicotinoids, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct, and I'll touch on it briefly, and Travis can follow up. But yes, again, as Travis mentioned earlier, there's numerous applications of these chemicals across the U.S. and the globe, for that matter. In Wisconsin, there's over 500 different products licensed for use in the state that contain neonics. And again, as Larry just pointed out, the vast majority of these chemicals used, at least in the agricultural parts of the U.S., is on seed applications. So, again, for field corn, for example, nearly 100% of the field corn seeds sold in the U.S. are pre-treated with insecticides like neonics and sometimes fungicides and other chemicals. And for soybeans, upwards of 65% of the seeds sold in the upper Midwest are treated with these chemicals prior to sale. So even if a producer, agricultural producer, wanted to not use these chemicals, it's very challenging for them to be able to purchase seed that do not have these chemicals already applied to them.
Mm. Travis, anything to add there?
Yeah, just that because it's on seeds as codes and it's on a wide variety of crops, sometimes those seeds are put in the ground, like in the winter and or early spring. And so now we have pesticides that are dissolving when the soils thaw and are entering the water cycle, almost year round.
So if this is a problem in terms of our insects, why are we doing anything about it? Maybe this forum is a way to start addressing this, but Mike, you want to talk about that a bit?
Sure. Frankly, I think relative to Europe, the Europeans have banned the use of neonics in many countries. My personal opinion is I think in the United States, we're kind of behind the times a little bit as far as understanding the impacts of these chemicals and having more intelligent management of these chemicals as well. So I think that's this forum hopefully will generate some interest. And again, there's increasing awareness across the country. There's a number of states now, maybe 6, 10, 12 states that have enacted legislation to reduce the use of these chemicals. So again, there's a number of different studies. The numbers of studies are increasing rapidly showing impacts of these chemicals. So I think as awareness increases, hopefully we'll be more intelligent on how we manage these chemicals.
Yeah. So when they're in the seed, when the neonics are in the seed, I mean, it infuses the entire plant, right?
Sure, that's the strategy. But what the few studies I've read suggest that about 90% of the neonics actually wash off the seeds before they're taken up by the crop plant. And again, being water soluble, they enter the soil quickly. And then, as Travis mentioned, that can be a direct pathway to our surface waters.
Yeah, our surface water. And what's the research or what research has been done on the effect on people?
Travis, do you want to
jump in, Travis?
Yeah, it's outside of my area of expertise, I think is the best way to answer that. But there are some studies coming out now showing pesticide impacts on children and adults. They're pretty widespread in the environment, so we're all exposed to some level.
Certainly, Travis. I'd offer, I read a recent study out of Iowa where, again, they focused on pesticide applicators in the state, but nearly all the applicators had detectable concentrations of neonics in their urine, and some studies done in Europe where they use people's hair as a kind of biomonitor of chemicals, and they found that upwards of about 30 or 40% of just the general population had neonics in their body. So as Travis just pointed out, they're pretty pervasive in the environment and not surprisingly showing up in humans.
Yeah, as well. Yeah, Mike Miller and Travis Schmidt, our guest today, Mike Stream, ecologist with the DNR of Wisconsin, Travis Schmidt, research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Wyoming Montana Water Science Center. And they are both speaking, and we're going to talk some more about this forum. Excuse me. They're both speaking on October 30th at the DeLuca Forum at the UW-Madison. It's a neonic forum. I think it's the first one, isn't it? Yeah, it's the very first one to address the issues surrounding neonicotinoids. You can join in with your own questions. The number 800-642-1234, or you can email us, email address talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at the use of neonicotinoid pesticides today with our guests. There's a forum that we've been talking about to discuss it in Madison on October 30th, and we'll tell you a little more about that as well as we move along today. But there's some pretty bad effects that are showing up in a lot of research, and neonicotinoids have been banned in parts of Europe. And we're talking about the effects on our plants and our animals and our insects today with our two guests, Mike Miller and Travis Schmidt. It's great to have Mike's with the DNR in Wisconsin, and Travis, a research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Wyoming Montana Water Science Center. So great to have both of them along. And again, questions, give a call, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Dennis in Two Rivers will give you a chance to join in.
Hi, Larry. Thanks. Well, this applies to raspberries because it's the only kind of gardening I have. The only trouble I have is with June bugs that come around now and then. So if I were to put any pesticides on them, I would wait until the June bugs come around on maybe every other year or whatever, and that would be after the pollination is done. So I just wonder, well, how many crops could that apply to? If they're just wait and see if there's going to be pests, and if there are, then maybe put the pesticides on, and maybe that's after the pollination is done.
Sure, I'd like to address that question. So for a long time, ag producers used a tactic called integrated pest management, where they would rotate crops, survey the fields to see if there were any type of pest outbreaks, and then only apply these chemicals when there was an outbreak of some significance. Now that we use these seed-applied neonics, they've kind of abandoned this integrated pest management strategy, and again, they're applying these chemicals regardless of if there's a need or not. And in brief conversations with some UW-Madison agronomists, they estimated that prior to the use of seed-applied neonics in the state of Wisconsin and elsewhere, that roughly about 5% of the corn in the state was treated with neonics. And frankly, as I understand it, as I recall, in essence, none of the soybeans were treated with neonics. And now that we're using these seed-applied routes of application, 100% of the corn, nearly 100% of the corn is being treated with neonics, and in very high proportion, over 50% of the soybeans. So we're applying these chemicals kind of irrespective of whether or not there's a problem.
And, I want to bring up DDT for a minute as well, because DDT is a long banned pesticide in our country. And how toxic are neonics compared to DDT?
Travis, did you want to handle that one?
That's a good question. I'm not sure exactly, but I will note that the reason why we have neonicotinoids is in fact because we had management strategies in place to reduce our reliance on DDT, and the problems with DDT and other compounds in that group of synthetic pesticides is that they were not very specific to insects, and so they had effects on wildlife. And so, for example, we had egg thinning in birds. And so there was a want to get new pesticides so we could manage insect pests. And so neonicotinoids were developed, and they are way more specific. And so they target insects very precisely. And so they reduce risks to those wildlife now. But because they're so much more specific and insects, that we see probably more effects on non-targeted vertebrates.
Yeah.
And I'd offer one more point, and I can't cite the particular study, but the estimate I recall is that neonics are thought to be between 7,000 and 10,000 times more toxic to insects than DDT. So Travis is certainly right that DDT was problematic for birds and mammals, humans included, whereas neonics are more of a targeted towards insects in particular. But again, as mentioned earlier, not only are these chemicals very effective at killing insect pests, but again, many of the different insect species that are fundamentally important to ecosystem health.
Yeah, absolutely. Laurel in Cottage Grove, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi, this is such a big issue. A number of years ago, I had incredible, first of all, I'm a civics and rural heritage preservation advocate. I'm native of Wisconsin, and I've lived in Tennessee for many years, but I visit all the time. I had a really interesting job for a national wholesale tree and shrub distributor that contracts with these big box stores across the nation. I was stationed at a particular Home Depot working for this provider of tree and shrubs, and I did notice every single plant that came in and tree had this little spike in it. And I read it, and it said, this plant has been treated with neonicotinoid. Now, this was 5 years ago I did this job. And I thought, well, that's strange. And it said, call this number for more information. Anyway, what I came to find out, every single plant that came in, flower, during the spring season, had that very same spike. This is a major consumer issue, and the consumer has to understand and read the labels and apply pressure on a national level, certainly local, starting with your local representatives and your stores. What I had come to learn was through a lot of the work with the EWG, Environmental Working Group, and other advocacy organizations, that there is a big movement to bring awareness to this. Of course, European cultures have already dealt with it, but it's really these big box stores. What Home Depot apparently in my region, I had brought it up, and everybody started getting these plants that were treated. But I think what this really is about is industrial agriculture being embedded into our modern way of life, and that is very complicated, but this has to be a consumer issue, which I think you can talk more about. But anyway, what I understood is several big box stores did get a lot of complaints, and they Lowe's had stopped buying from retailers that were, or wholesalers that were, using neonics. Now, that was encouraging. Whole Foods, same thing. So people just need to really be involved. There's so much we can do just inside from our own home, knowing, you know, applying pressure at the level of where we shop.
As consumers. Yeah. Laurel, thanks for calling. I'll ask you both to comment on that. Mike, start with you.
Sure. Certainly the business of producing and selling neonics is a big business. There's four major producers globally, and each one of them, their sales are upwards of about $10 billion with a B dollars annually. So it's a big business. And kind of curiously enough, the Bayer chemical company out of Germany, those chemicals are banned for use in Germany, but they still export them to the U.S. and a number of other countries. So, you know, it's a big business, presumably very profitable. So not surprisingly, those entities are going to be reluctant to kind of reduce their sales of those chemicals.
Yeah. Travis?
Yeah, there's been a transition in how we use pesticides, and we once used a more judicious application for when we had problems, and now we use them to prevent problems.
Yeah, yeah. Tim in Oregon, we'll go to you. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I live in a very natural place, Hook Lake Bog. I'm in the middle of it. I've noticed a precipitously drop in insects that's off the charts. We used to have tons of, lightning bugs or whatever, fireflies. They're all way down. I used to drive down the road and had to clean my windshield off with bugs. Not one bug this year on my windshield. The insects have gone way down, and I'm serious. There's something going on. They planted this soybean field for the last two or three years, and they sprayed it, and the spray was at least 2 feet off the ground. I went through it with my car, and I walked through it, and I developed an earache that was so severe. I looked it up that these applicators that put this stuff on, they have 90% hearing loss. But I've seen the insects in this area, which are used to be so thick that you just have to wipe your hands away. Everything, the deer flies, the mosquitoes. I know it's a drought year, but maybe the birds, too, are eating up a lot more. But there's been a huge decline in the insect population.
Mike, I'll start with you.
Sure. There's been some studies primarily out of Europe showing pretty precipitous declines in insect populations, primarily terrestrial insects. But I think the same holds true for aquatic insects as well. And unfortunately, in the United States, we have a relatively limited amount of data to show these trends. So, again, we've got a lot of anecdotal evidence, like our caller just mentioned. Frankly, the impetus for this forum was that it's partly sponsored by the Trout Unlimited organization, and trout anglers in particular are very keen observers of nature, and they oftentimes fish the same streams year after year, take meticulous notes about what insects are hatching, how many, that sort of thing. And they've been noticing over the last few decades that similarly, as the caller mentioned, very dramatic declines in these insects that they'd again try to match with their fly fishing to catch trout. So again, people on the out in the environment are some of the kind of first people to pick up on some of these population changes in insects.
Yeah, Travis. And by the way, you did a national water survey, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I've been involved in a number of national water surveys. And one of the ones most recently we did was we sampled about 500 streams across the continental U.S. And we looked at bugs and fish and algae, and we measured about more than 220 pesticide compounds in the streams. And we were just trying to ask the question, like, can we detect that pesticides in streams are related with changes in invertebrate communities? And, you know, it's kind of a good news, bad news story. I mean, the good news is in stream ecosystems, we're not seeing these. There's a lot of headlines with the terrestrial insects, like the in insect apocalypse is upon us. And I do not see that. We do not see that in streams. But what we do see is when pesticides are high in streams, specifically neonicotinoids, we see declines in pesticides. Especially, you know, now we're in rivers, we're integrating what's happening over the entire landscape. So we see a lot of mixtures. And one of the outcomes of our studies was looking at two of the most commonly detected neonicotinoids, clothianidin and imidacloprid. Mm-hmm. And what we measured in a lab study and in the field was that when you have those two neonicotinoids in mixture, we see stronger effects on stream invertebrates than you do when you just see one of those compounds in the water.
So they kind of working together in a way to create a problem.
Yes, sir. Yep.
So I want to give kudos to Travis and his colleagues at the USGS. Frankly, they did a study back in 2013. It was called the Midwest Water Quality Assessment Study. And when I read the results of that study, that set off alarm bells in my head. And so that precipitated, frankly, the Wisconsin DNR to begin collecting data from streams as far as the concentrations of neonics. And so we did a study back in 2020 and sampled a random population of streams across the state. And based on the concentrations of neonics we were seeing in the streams and based on using laboratory toxicity data for aquatic insects, we made some estimates that upwards of about 3,000 miles of streams in Wisconsin, at least in 2022, had neonic concentrations that were sufficiently high to be acutely toxic to aquatic invertebrates, insects in particular, and then roughly about 17%, and I think that was about 7,000 miles of streams in the state probably have had at the time chronic concentrations of these neonics. So we don't have direct evidence like the USGS studies that Matt is referring to, but if we again take lab data and couple that with monitoring data, we can make some fairly intelligent estimates of what the impacts may be to Wisconsin's stream and river resources.
Yeah, it's Let's get something else. Helen in Madison, your turn. Hi, Helen.
Yes, hello. Couple questions. A few of my questions have been answered. One is who makes the stuff, and then how do we know if the seeds or plants we buy has it? But two questions that I haven't heard anyone ask yet is, one, what's the effect on birds? And two, does the DNR use neonicotinoids on their, because they do a lot of property management, obviously. Do they still use neonicotinoids?
No, I'm not certain when this occurred. Roughly within the last two or three years, they've banned the use of neonics on state properties. And as far as this question is, you know, what are the impacts to birds? There's been a few studies that show that, again, when these seeds are planted, they're coated with neonics. If there happen to be some birds feeding on the residue seeds on the surface of the crop field or whatever, they that could be detrimental, where they lose weight, the birds lose weight, and it impacts their ability to migrate, that sort of thing. But I think the major impact to the bird populations and all other insect feeding animals, whether it's bats or spiders or whatever, is that, again, this major loss in the food chain. I'll give one example. There's a mayfly species called Hexigenia. It lives in the Mississippi River and lakes and rivers with a lot of soft sediment. They live on the stream or river bottom for their as a larval stage of the insect. And there's been some recent studies done on the upper Mississippi River that shows that there's been a major decline in this particular mayfly. And they, again, these mayflies hatch out by the billions, and they're actually measured in metric tons, the number of insects hatching at any one season. And again, the researchers equated that to food for birds, and they estimated that a reduction in emergence was enough of a food source that could feed upwards of 25 million birds from when they hatched to fledging. So, again, a key food source that has been lost on the Upper Mississippi River. And there's been a study initiated this year with the US EPA and Upper Mississippi River states to better define, you know, what's causing this major decline.
Amazing figures. Travis, comment?
Yeah, I mean, the prey bases are impacted, and some of those studies we did for the regional stream quality assessment, we actually measured how emergence of aquatic insects changed in response to increased exposures to imidacloprid and clothianidin. But the other researchers have also measured this out in the field. And this is an incredibly important process. So there's a reason why people go look for birds near water. And it's because the birds and the bats are coming there because insects that come from water are more nutritious than terrestrial insects. And so those prey items are more important to bats and birds than those that you would find crawling in a field. And so that's why they're congregating in that area. So when we get pesticides that have effects on non-target organisms, it's not only killing or adversely affecting the invertebrates in the stream, but those invertebrates complete their life cycle in the terrestrial ecosystem. And so those effects sort of cause a trophic cascade, and you start seeing these effects, these indirect effects on higher consumers like birds.
Hmm. Our guests today, as we talk neonicotinoids, Michael Miller, stream biologist with the Wisconsin DNR, Travis Schmidt with the U.S. Geological Survey's Wyoming Montana Water Science Center. They're two of the speakers. There are several other speakers as well who will be presenting at this forum on Wednesday, October 30th at the DeLuca Forum at UW-Madison's Institute for Discovery, just down the street from here, from where we're sitting right now. And Mike, people can participate in this?
Right. I'd certainly encourage folks. I think that in-person attendance is the time to enroll for that is passed. But again, you can certainly go online. If you just do a web search for Wisconsin Neonic Forum, you'll find a link to the forum. And again, you can certainly register to attend online, so you know, get all the opportunities of hearing all these great speakers and learn more about the topic. Again, we'll provide an overview of the impacts of neonics, but then we also have some experts, and you know, Travis included, to talk about how useful these chemicals are in the agricultural world and impacts to biota. And then folks will, some of the presenters will talk about what other states have done to better manage these chemicals and, you know, how can we address this concern.
So lots of causes, and how do we address this concern at that forum? That and the address, what do we type into that? We'll probably have it up on our, I'm sure we have it up on our page. But
right, if you just typed in Wisconsin Neonic Forum, it'll pop up right away.
It'll pop up right away. Mike Miller and Travis Schmidt, our guests today. I'm Larry Miller. You're listening to WPR News. Taking a look at neonics on the program today and talking about the forum that's going to be addressing the issues surrounding neonicotinoids with our two guests, Mike Miller and Travis Schmidt. Lines are all full. We've got emails. Let's take a call from John in Kaukauna. Hi, John.
Hello.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Hello. Well, I'm calling kind of late into the show, and I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but we took a trip last week from Kaukauna to Denver and driving around in the Rockies. And from Kaukauna to Dubuque, Iowa, we barely had any indication of insects on the windshield at all. But from Dubuque all the way through Iowa, Nebraska, and up into the Denver and the Rockies, it was a good thing we had to stop and get gas once in a while because the windshield, dare I say something like the good old days, was just covered with quarter and nickel size and bigger blasts of insects all over, you know, and it was hard to clean off.
Well, Mike, you want to comment?
That observation. I have some friends that are, again, avid fly fishers that live on the East Coast, and they make an annual trip to some of the Western waters that are outstanding trout waters. Anyways, point is the comments I've heard from several of these folks are very similar to what our caller just mentioned, where, again, they're driving from the East Coast, they're making multiple stops in the eastern states to, among other things, wash off their windshield, and then when they got to the Midwest, that was not a problem, and then they'd farther out into the plains, again, they're having this problem with their windshield being inundated with insects. It's an observation that a number of people have mentioned.
And, of course, the Midwest is where we got corn and soybeans. And
Right. And that offer, in the bad old days, farmers, truck drivers used to take window screening and wire to the front of the radiators on their vehicles to prevent them from being from the radiators becoming plugged up with the insects. And frankly, you don't see that anymore these days. So again, lots of anecdotal evidence, but unfortunately not a lot of rigorous studies in the scientific realm.
Yeah. Julie in Madison has a question. Hi, Julie.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I am fortunate to live in a neighborhood that doesn't have too many people getting lawn care services. But I do see them around public buildings, and I see them in other neighborhoods. And I'm wondering, how can anyone find out if neonics are part of the spray used by commercial and residential lawn treatment companies?
May or may not be able to answer that, other than calling.
Right. I unfortunately can't answer that. Perhaps, I don't know if Travis has any suggestions.
No, sir. It's going to be, I think, dependent on where you're at. Who's doing the application?
Yeah, there are some that advertise as organic, but you need to probably go a step further and say, well, what chemicals are you using, and what are the chemical makeup of the products?
Agreed.
Yeah, there you go, Julie. Margo in Menominee, your turn. Hi, Margo.
Hi, this is Margo. Just want to comment and thank you, gentlemen, for all of this respectful conversation having to do with pesticides, and your interactions with the callers is just fantastic. I want to let you know about a fiction book that actually has pesticides as part of the plot, and it just was released October 5th. And it's by Pulitzer Prize winner Louise Erdrich. and her last name is spelled E-R-D-R-I-C-H. And the name of the book is The Mighty Red, and it is about sugar beet farming in the Red River Valley of the North. And, yeah, so pesticides are in there.
There you go, Margot. Thanks for calling. Haven't seen that one yet. Haven't seen that book yet, but I guess it's just out. Appreciate it. Karen and Monona, your turn. Hi, Karen.
I have both a question and the comment, and listening to what I just heard, I'm going to go with the comment first because we are just doing this to ourselves. I mean, I'm not personally responsible. I use spray on my yards a little bit, but the thing that most impressed me is something I heard about a month and a half ago, that we get our oxygen from all the little critters and birds and insects and whatever, still small amounts, but in total, they provide more oxygen to us as human beings to breathe than people do. So that means that if we are in Wisconsin or whatever, but it sounds an awful lot like a lot in Wisconsin, we're just impacting our breathing air.
Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not certain. I don't think I have anything to add to that. I would offer that, again, of all the animals described on planet Earth right now, 1.2 million animals have been described on planet Earth, and roughly about 85% or close to a million of those animals are insects. So, you know, frankly, we're woefully ignorant about you know, the role of many of these animals in our environment. So, again, the fact that we're losing some, and again, although we know there's 1.2 million animals on the planet right now, it's estimated that there's probably closer to like 8 million. We just not cataloged them all. So, again, there's a high likelihood we're losing very important organisms that, frankly, we may not know that exist or certainly don't know their role in the environment. So I think we need to be more intelligent how we address some of these issues.
Yeah, for sure. And you're nodding in agreement, Travis.
Yeah, I'm just going to emphasize that in the stream ecosystems, the biodiversity and the biomass of organisms in streams and rivers is dominated by insects and invertebrates, and that energy moves up the food chain and sort of like a pyramid. And so when the insects get disturbed and affected, it does change how, you know, the sustenance and the food supply to everything above it.
How big of an environmental threat are neonic pesticides compared to, I don't know, habitat loss or perhaps climate change?
Sure, all those factors have been implicated as far as impacting insects. Again, certainly in the agricultural realm, sediment from crop fields flowing into our streams, it tends to blanket the stream bed, and that's really detrimental to the health of the aquatic invertebrates. And also, many of you know, we have excess nutrients in our surface waters as well. So certainly, I think there's rapidly growing evidence that these insecticides are having a very detrimental effect on our aquatic resources. But, you know, certainly recognize that it's kind of one of, you know, maybe four or five other major stressors affecting our aquatic and terrestrial resources.
Yeah.
I would just add that if you compare the rates of change and the use and the number of compounds that we're putting on the market with the rates of change that we're seeing in land use and other global change issues, some of our colleagues in the literature have done this and shown that green chemistry revolution and our use of synthetic chemicals is changing at a rate that should be considered on par with these other larger issues that we're talking about increasingly in society.
Laurel in Cottage Grove called but couldn't stay, wanted to add that consumers need to ask their local nurseries for plants not treated with neonicotinoids. The only way to pressure for less use of them. But a larger issue is still with seed corn, and that is where some changes may need to be made.
Right. And I realize we have kind of limited time left here, but a fundamental issue here is that, you know, one, we certainly need pesticides to control crop pests. You know, I certainly understand that. And again, things like neonics have been very effective on certain crops like potatoes and other vegetable crops and fruit, that sort of thing. But again, in the state of Wisconsin, as an example, we plant upwards of about 5 million acres of corn each year, and soybeans is somewhere around, I believe, about 2.3 or 2.5 million acres of soybeans. The University of Wisconsin-Madison agronomists did an interesting study where they found that, again, when using seed-applied neonics in soybeans, they found very little increases in crop yields associated with the use of these chemicals. Again, this study was done, was led by UW-Madison, but there was 11 other kind of top-flight universities across the U.S. in primarily soybean-producing states that were participated in this study. Again, these were agronomists. They weren't ecologists or entomologists. So again, you know, the question is, what benefit are ag producers getting from these chemicals? Similarly, a study done at the Cornell University on field corn, they found similarly the same type of findings where, again, they compared fields where neonic-treated seeds were used with fields where neonic-treated seeds are not used. And there, too, they found little improvement in crop yields. And oftentimes, the yields are so negligible, it didn't even offset the cost of the chemicals themselves. So, again, we just need to kind of take a closer look at this type of information and make more intelligent choices about how we manage these chemicals.
Do you think they should be banned, neonics?
Again, as a DNR employee, I'm not to be an advocate, I guess, even though I probably have been today. but again, there's, you know, the researchers and various European countries. Again, the European Union has banned or vastly restricted the use of many of these chemicals. Again, it's occurring in a few states, and where more studies have been done, they've been banned in Canada. So, again, I think the preponderance of evidence suggests that the impacts are exceed the benefits for certain crops, again, and particularly in the use of seed-applied neonics.
But yeah.
Again, it does not necessarily hold for, again, vegetable crops or fruit crops or whatever, but I think we need to take a closer look at the value of these compounds.
Yeah. Travis?
Yeah, I work for an agency where we don't advocate for policies. We use data collection and interpretation to provide information to decision makers, and so that's where our observations of the prevalence of neonicotinoids being detected in 30% of the rivers in the United States that we surveyed, and that in most of the ecoregions we saw that stream invertebrate communities were in fact negatively affected by the presence of those neonicotinoids is important information for decision makers to consider in setting policies, but by no means can I advocate for one decision or the other.
Good points. And this forum, if you really want to learn as much as there, you can probably learn about neonics. It'll be at this forum on Wednesday, October 30th at UW-Madison's Institute for Discovery. You can go online to view it. And I think a small charge, $10 or something, is all. And this is like, there must be at least a dozen people talking about this. And a big thanks to both of you for being with us today. I appreciate it, Mike and Travis. Thank you so much. And we'll hopefully have a chance to visit with you again. Appreciate it.
Very good. I certainly appreciate the opportunity.
Appreciate it very much. And I appreciate our staff as well. Clara Neipert, Joel Padnott, our directors today, our producers, and our technical director, Jeff Robbins, and Lee Rayburn, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.